Hi, this is Sarah, and thanks for joining the adventure at Nature Finds a Way, a fictional biology podcast. Welcome to episode one. Before we get started, I guess I should introduce myself and the show. My name is Sarah Given, and I've been a book lover and a biology nerd for as long as I can remember. Growing up on the coast as a kid, I'd spend my summers with my nose in a tide pool or in a book, and really that hasn't changed much. I've been lucky enough to travel near and far to see all kinds of ecosystems, and yet a part of me still laments the fact that I haven't seen a dragon or a tribble or an ant. Thank goodness, then, that there are so many amazing pieces of fiction out there that transport me to Pern or Middle Earth or wherever it is that tribbles are from. I hope you'll join me as we explore together the overlapping worlds of fiction and biology, touching on things like evolution, ecology, and physiology as they're portrayed in the fictional worlds we know and love. This first episode will be about the epic Dragon Riders of Pern series by Anne McCaffrey. If you haven't yet visited Pern, I hope you'll give it a shot. It's definitely got some fascinating biology that I look forward to sharing with you all. I'm still working on my list of fictional ecosystems, but if you have any to suggest, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at naturefindsapod, or on my website, naturefindsapod.com. I look forward to chatting about all things fiction and biology as we take this journey together. Don't forget you can subscribe to Nature Finds a Way on iTunes or through your favorite podcast app. The Dragon Riders of Pern series was created by Anne McCaffrey. The first book, Dragonflight, was published in 1968, and the series comprises two trilogies plus several interconnected books, some standalone books, and many short stories. Some of the later works were co-written by her son Todd. Anne McCaffrey was the first woman to win a Hugo Award and a Nebula Award. She had an amazing writing career, creating several other remarkable science fiction series, and she passed away in 2011. I was introduced to the Dragon Riders series in the mid-90s by my mom, who owned several of the novels already. I was such a bookworm at that point, and I have so many fond memories of reading Dragonflight, and then being so beyond excited that my mom already had five or six more books that followed right on. She and I constantly checked the bookstores for updates to the series, and despite currently owning very few hard copies of books, I still have many, many Anne McCaffrey works on my shelves. Maybe don't tell my mom that I have most of them. If you've never read any of the books, I'd highly recommend them. There's definitely some aspects of them that, in rereading, feel quite dated or even old-fashioned, but I do hope you'll give them a chance. This podcast will have some spoilers, but hopefully not too many about the character-based plots, or really much of any of the plots that you wouldn't get by reading the backs of at least the beginning novels. I really am hopeful that some of you will give this series a shot, and I don't want to spoil some of the fun twists and turns that you have in store. The books are set on the fictional planet of Pern, located in the constellation Sagittarius, orbiting a star called Rukbat. A real star, actually. In addition to the one habitable planet, the system also has a rogue planet known as the Red Star, and an Oort cloud that sits at one edge of the planetary system. Now, it might seem odd to discuss so much about the solar system in a biology podcast, but it turns out that the Red Star, on its oddly shaped orbit, drags stuff out of the Oort cloud and brings it close to the planet. This turns out to have a pretty substantial effect on the planet's ecosystem. Pern was originally settled by humans in the distant future for us. These original settlers noticed there had been some sort of relatively recent, massive mortality event covering large chunks of the planet. Big swaths of vegetation had been killed off, but seemed to be quickly regenerating. There was much speculation about diseases or space viruses or all kinds of things, but it wasn't until 8 years later that the Red Star's orbit brought material from the Oort cloud into range, causing a terrible kind of meteor shower. The material falling from the sky came to be known as thread, and it destroyed anything biological on contact. Hundreds of people were killed that first fall from burns and scars, and the cycles of thread fall had an immense impact on the society and the biology of the planet. When the first novel begins, however, we're more than 2,000 years after the first settlements on Pern were established, and there's no remaining knowledge of space travel or other planets. Pern society seems to be comparable to medieval times in terms of technology and society. Most people live in towns or villages known as holds, and connected to the holds are guilds. A grouping of holds and guild halls then supports a weir, and this is where the dragons come in. Weirs are where the dragons and their riders live. Dragons, at hatching, choose their rider through a sort of psychic bond, which then allows them to communicate telepathically. Dragon riders have an esteemed place in society because dragons are the best defense against threadfall. They crunch up these special phosphorus rocks, which allows them to breathe fire, and fire destroys thread. The whole society of holds and guilds supporting dragon riders, essentially tithing to the dragon riders, is essential to the ongoing survival of people, livestock, and crops. Most settlements are carved into rock faces or hidden into caves, but the dragons have the very important task of protecting arable land from being destroyed by thread. Turns out they're so good at this task because they were specifically bred for it. When the original settlers arrived on Pern, they found it was home to a species of small flying lizard-like creatures they called dragonettes. These tiny creatures would impress on the first creature that fed them, kind of similar to a duckling. In the initial years of the colony, they were mainly a fascination of children or sometimes a pet, but during the first Threadfall, the colonists realized that the dragonettes self-organized to go out and destroy the thread by breathing fire. The colonists, still having access to very advanced science fiction-y technology, bred the dragonettes into the massive dragons that would be able to protect the colonists for millennia to come. The main breeding changes were size and telepathy. Let's start with size. The original dragonettes were only a few feet long, whereas modern dragons in the first series of the books range in size from 20 to about 45 meters. This is a huge change and clearly had something to do with the special breeding technology that the colonists had access to. The telepathy was achieved by using a science fiction drug called mentasynth, which seems a bit far-fetched, but at the same time, the rules of dragon telepathy are very strictly established throughout the books before we learn in probably about 8 or so books in that there was actually a technobabbly kind of explanation for it. Rather than focusing on how, though, what I really love about the series is that it uses the telepathy to make the dragons be actual characters in the books. A dragon and its rider have an intense bond, and honestly, the dragons have some of the best lines in the books, even though only the readers and their rider are privy to these quips. So, a bit about dragons. Obviously, these dragons are gigantic, up to 45 meters long. And they can breathe fire, although, like I said before, the fire breathing comes from eating a special phosphorus-based rock, sort of crunching it up, and then can exhale fire, basically. There's some sort of basically a second stomach, and they use that to help to destroy thread. So the dragons, with their riders, will fly during Threadfall and go around and protect the lands from the dangerous thread. Because the dragons are super smart and are also telepathic, so the dragons are able to communicate with each other, which then lets the riders indirectly communicate with each other. It's a pretty fancy system of sort of like wings of flying. And because of the huge importance to the settlements on Pern, dragons and their riders have special status on Pern. They generally aren't farmers or don't have to feed themselves. The dragons are allowed to hunt pretty much anywhere, although, they try to be respectful of the people that live around them. Dragons mostly will eat meat. They are almost entirely carnivorous. Some will eat fish, but they prefer like large mammal type things. There's actually some interesting stuff about how the colonists back like 2,000 years before the sort of main series of books, how the colonists adapted the earth species for life on Pern. The dragons actually have a boron skeleton rather than a calcium skeleton. And so as these dragons got huge, 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 there's not a lot of like large livestock that's native to Pern. Like there's some small birds and some fish and all that kind of stuff. But there's nothing big enough to sustain these giant dragons. So then they had to sort of breed the livestock that they'd brought with them to be a source of boron. So they did some, technobabbly science, and basically, instead of just being a high source of calcium, large animals, I guess in the protein, there's some like a strong source of boron that the dragons can use. I don't, well, here, I'm just gonna like get it out there that I'm a super nerd about the Dragon Riders of Pern. I have like a little encyclopedia book, a guide to the Dragon Riders of Pern, if you will. And so that's where I learned about the boron thing. I don't remember reading about it, but I'm sure it's somewhere, like maybe in a short story or something that I have read, but that's where I heard that part of things. Unlike lizards on Earth, dragons are generally warm-blooded. They do like to be somewhere warm, kind of like how cats like to be somewhere warm. Like they can keep themselves warm, but if they can hang out in a warm spot, they are generally happy dragons, and happy dragons are the best dragons. Their dragon skin isn't really scaly so much as smooth and soft. Dragon riders put a special salve on their dragons, sometimes after if they get scarred by thread, but also just to keep them moisturized and dry, and it's part of their sort of bonding experiences, a rider looking after their dragon. So, because this isn't really the fictional sociology podcast, I'll leave you to explore the intricate societies of Pern yourselves, the differences between holders and crafters and dragon riders. But let's now move on to an equally intricate exploration of dragon breeding. Dragons have two sexes, which, considering they're an alien species, isn't necessarily expected, but does make things a bit simpler for us. Dragons also come in different colors, which seem to be a bit more similar to the different roles in a bee colony than they are strictly genetic color morphs. The original dragonettes and the modern dragons have a queen who's always gold, and the males are either brown or bronze. Bronze dragons are much larger than brown dragons, and queen dragons are, of course, the largest kind of dragon. A gold and a brown mating is good. It'll produce really healthy greens and blues and maybe some bronzes and browns as well, but it won't produce any gold queens. Whereas a gold queen mating with a bronze dragon will produce some gold queens, especially when necessary, like if there is a shortage of queen dragons or a shortage of dragons in general. Blue dragons are also male, but are so much smaller than the browns and bronzes that they aren't generally able to compete to mate with a gold queen. Green dragons are female dragons, but turns out that they are infertile due to ingesting firestone. Or at least that's the sort of expected theory. It's not super clear if green dragonettes are also infertile. Queen dragons and queen dragonettes don't ingest firestone because they can't or don't. Again, not super clear. I'm guessing it's kind of a bit of both. So, queen dragons are the only mothers of all the dragons. They're the only females that are able to breed. Blue dragons are, at least as far as the books have said, are also effectively infertile because they are so much smaller than the other males. So somehow, matings between queens that are gold and then males that are bronze or brown can lead to this greater range of color variations. Green and blue dragons do make up the bulk of the dragon population, about 80%. Gold dragons are less than 1%, and bronze dragons are about 5%, I think I read somewhere, and brown dragons then are the rest, about 15%. So there's some interesting genetics involved there. Maybe something to do with the genetic engineering that happened in the early history of the planet, or maybe just some weird, crazy alien genetics. I'm definitely not going to be drawing any Punnett squares on a podcast, but it's a cool exploration to think about how this color variation happens because it's not strictly genetic. There's definitely something else going on. Like, if there's already three or four queens in a weir of dragons, there probably won't be any more queen eggs. There's some epigenetics or environmental stuff happening there too. Female dragons exhibit a strong mating drive. Gold dragons will rise to mate about once a year, whereas green dragons, even though they're infertile, will rise about three or four times a year, I guess just recreational mating. Dragons will mate in midair with the female being chased until the males catch her, usually because she's allowed him to catch her. Dragon mating flights are a pretty big deal with the books and go to some really interesting places. For the sake of the podcast, I'm definitely more intrigued in like the processes of it, but there's some great explorations through the fiction of dragon mating and also the implications through the telepathy into their riders. So definitely goes to some interesting plot points because of this dragon mating drive. So when a gold dragon rises to mate, pretty much all the bronze and brown dragons will go and try to catch her. Now, the queen dragons are substantially larger than the brown dragons and quite a bit larger than the bronze dragons. So it's pretty much up to her who, which dragon is allowed to catch her and mate with her. Green dragons also are, because they're so small, will are much more maneuverable and quick compared to the other male dragons. So again, it's kind of, it's almost always the dragon, the female dragon's choice about which dragon she gets to mate with. And so even though the green dragons will rise a few more times during the year, they will always rise when the gold dragon rises, and then basically the sort of rejected males that didn't catch the gold dragons will go and find them a green dragon and, you know, get their mating urges out. So there's one final facet of dragons that I'm kind of intentionally skimming over, and that's the fact that they can teleport. I'm skimming over it for a few reasons. One, because I don't understand how it works biologically. And also because of spoilers. There's some super major plot points that I definitely want to leave you to explore, but the fact that dragons can travel, sort of transport themselves and their riders is not, it's, I mean, everybody knows it at the beginning of the books, like it's not a big shocking surprise. So basically what happens is the dragon and their riders, they have to have in their mind a picture of where they're going, like a strong landmark or something, yeah, something very, very specific. And then they just kind of like wink and they end up there. They, on longer trips, it's very, very cold on the trip. Like it's not super instantaneous, but it's pretty quick. And they call that sort of period between. I don't know exactly how it works from a fictional perspective, or from a fictional perspective, it works out really well. There's obviously some internal logic in terms of the dragons having to know where they're going, and they can bring the rider that's on them. One dragon can sort of think one place and convey that thought to the other dragons. So a group of dragons can go where one dragon has been before. And yeah, like the fictional aspects of the telepathy, I think, are so much more interesting than the sort of science aspects of it. This isn't something that got bred into the dragons. The dragonettes are able to do it too. There's a really great scene when the colonists first discover that dragonettes can teleport, and it's one of my favorites. So I'll leave that for you to discover in Dragon's Dawn, which is kind of like a prequel. Which is kind of like a prequel novel in the series. In terms of recommendations, I would definitely recommend starting with the first series, which is Dragonflight, Dragon Quest, and then the White Dragon. The White Dragon's probably my least favorite of those three, but there's also some really great parts of that. Then there's a second trilogy that kind of overlaps with the first trilogy. Dragon Song, Dragon Singer, and Dragon Drums are called the Harper Hall trilogy, and those are my favorite books. They're definitely the least, well, they're the least biological about the dragons, but there's lots and lots about the fire lizards, which are what the later colonists end up calling the sort of slightly evolved dragonettes that they are exposed to. So yeah, I love the Harper Hall trilogy the most. I just, when I was looking up the book titles, I'm just looking at a recommended reading, recommended reading order, which is so Dragonflight and then Dragon Quest of the first trilogy, and then read the Harper Hall trilogy, Dragon Song, Dragon Singer, and Dragon Drums, and then go back and read the White Dragon. And I would probably agree with that. And then once you've done that, there's a huge sort of further exploration. So there's some books that take place before these two trilogies. Like I said, Dragon's Dawn is sort of more science fiction-y because it's back when the original colonists had settled. And then there's a few that go sort of on from that, because in a previous life I was a marine biologist, and I'm still a huge biology, like marine biology and whale and dolphin nerd. There's a book called The Dolphins of Pern, which when that came out, I was pretty much the most excited that I've ever been about a novel, at least until that point. It's one of my favorites. It's not necessarily the best of the Dragonrider books, but I have a very fond spot for it in my heart because of the dolphins. And also there's some pretty cool stuff that happens in there. I, to be honest, haven't read some of the later ones. In the early 2000s, Anne McCaffrey's son, Todd, started helping to write some of the books. I think just she was getting a bit older. She still had ideas. So I think she was more of the idea person and he was the actual writer of the books at various points. I think I've read a few of them. I'm looking at this list and I definitely have not read all of them. I don't The couple that I did read were fine. They were fun, but at a certain point, I kind of just preferred to just reread the old ones that I know and love rather than read books that weren't at the standard of rather than read books that were kind of a little bit disappointing. There's nothing wrong with them, and I'm sure there's some great stuff, and I'll probably dive in there eventually. Maybe. We'll see. Yeah, so those are my recommendations. As well, I keep hearing about speculation about a TV series or a mini series about the Dragonriders of Pern, and I, as much as I would love to see these dragons in real life, I have such a strong visual impression of the dragons. Like the books that my mom had are old paperbacks that have sort of, I don't even know if they really have pictures of dragons on the front. Like, they're sort of impressionistic pictures of dragons on the covers. So when we bought a hardcover one that had like the big glossy cover, and there's somebody else's drawing of a dragon, I was like, not sure how I feel about that. So yeah, like I'm not like I wouldn't. I'll watch it if something happens, but I'm not like jumping at the bit to have a visual representation of the Dragon Riders of Pern. It's probably not going to be great, but who knows? Who knows? And again, like it's been rumored for ages and ages and ages and nothing. So we will see. There's definitely more biological fun to be had with the Dragon Riders of Pern. Researching for this podcast has me definitely wanting to reread some of my favorite books again. Thank you for joining me on this quick trip to Pern. If you want to join me next time, you can subscribe to Nature Finds a Way on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Nature Finds a Pod, and you can visit the website for show notes and references at naturefindsapod.com. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time. Nature Finds a Way is produced and created by Sarah Given and is hosted by Ficerum Connections. Thanks for joining us.